for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. With students returning to class and campus and the flu season not far off, federal, state, and local officials are preparing for a possible resurgence of H1N1 swine flu. Officials warn against panicking. They don't know yet how severe a return of the virus may be. Here in the studio to talk about government preparations for the expected return of swine flu, Dr. Bruce Gellin. He's director of the Health and Human Services National Vaccine Program Office. Good morning to you, Dr.
Gellin. Good morning,
Diane.
Thank you.
And also Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. Good morning to you, Dr. Fauci.
Good morning, Diane.
And we will be taking your calls, your questions and comments, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Joining us now from her office in Atlanta is Anne Schuchat. She's director of the Center for Immunization and Respiratory Disease at the Centers for Disease Control. Good morning to you, Dr. Schuchat.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. What should we expect in the upcoming flu season?
You know, we've had this new H1N1 virus in the United States here since April, with a big outbreak in the spring and continuing transmission in the summer with outbreaks in camps in 40 states. And we do expect that as students get back to school in the fall, that we may see some increases in this strain. We don't know how bad it will be, but we really are working hard to be prepared for the increase in disease that we do expect to occur.
Do we know now how many Americans might be infected with the H1N1?
Well, we think that more than 1 million people have already had this virus, but we expect a lot more to get it. And so the government is working hard to be prepared to minimize the impact that the virus has on illness and also the disruption that it causes to our society.
Now, of the 1 million who've already had it, will they now have immunity?
We don't really know. You know, the virus can change, and so whether a previous influenza illness will protect you against the next one, it's not really a reliable thing. Also, many of the people who've had respiratory illnesses may not have had exactly this virus, so it's a little bit difficult to be sure that if you had a bout of severe respiratory illness in the past several months, that it was due to this strain.
And I must say, that's my concern. How will doctors specifically be able to identify the differences between regular flu and swine flu?
Actually, what we think it's going to be important for doctors and patients to do is to treat this illness carefully, to recommend antiviral medicines when people are quite sick or people who have symptoms have complicating factors that might make their illness worse. Pregnant women, for instance, with fever or respiratory symptoms really need to be treated. It's going into the fall, we're probably going to be managing influenza in general. We'll be testing to understand what's going on with the virus, but we won't need to find out for every individual person which strain they have. Unfortunately, the tests that we have right now aren't good enough that in a office you can differentiate which kind of flu a person has.
So if the tests aren't clear enough, how will a doctor know whether to offer a regular flu vaccination or a swine flu vaccine?
We think that many people need to get both vaccines this year. The seasonal flu vaccine should be available very soon in communities around the country, and we recommend that for most Americans. The H1N1 vaccine, we're expecting to be available later in the fall, probably in October, and that's going to be recommended for five focused populations in particular: pregnant women, healthcare workers, people living with babies under 6 months, children and young adults 6 months to 24 years of age, and older adults up through the age of 65 who have chronic conditions like diabetes and asthma. All of those people really need to be thinking about getting the H1N1 vaccine when it becomes available. But for those groups and for the elderly, we pretty much recommend the seasonal flu vaccine, and you should get that as soon as it's available.
And finally, Dr. Schuchat, what's happening in the southern hemisphere regarding H1N1?
You know, it's winter in the southern hemisphere, and they're having their usual flu season. And in many countries within the southern hemisphere, this H1N1 virus has caused extra problems on top of the seasonal flu. There are a number of countries where the H1N1 virus has caused a lot of illness, some of it less serious, where people can stay home and take care of themselves and get better in a few days, and some of it quite severe with hospitalizations and even deaths. The pattern looks similar and the virus looks similar that we've tested from the southern hemisphere. It's giving us a clue about what we may see in the fall and winter here, and that's one of the reasons we're taking this so seriously.
Dr. Ann Schuchat, she's director for the Center for Disease Control's Center for Immunization and Respiratory Disease. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And now turning to you, Dr. Bruce Gellin, what do we know about H1N1 now that we didn't know back in April?
Well, one of the things, and Dr. Schuchat mentioned, is that the patterns are now becoming more and more clear to us. In April, it wasn't clear as it was emerging exactly how this was gonna play out. But what we've seen both in the United States and, as Dr. Schuchat mentioned, in the Southern Hemisphere, the patterns seem to be similar in the populations that are being affected. That helps us very much in thinking through of how we're going to design our immunization programs. And as Dr. Schuchat mentioned, some of the risk groups that have suffered from this vaccine, from this virus, are the ones who are being prioritized for the vaccine.
Dr. Fauci, this H1N1 virus seems so curious because of the portion of the population it hits the hardest. For example, pregnant women, for example, young adults who would seem to be in the prime of health. What's going on here?
Well, I think the overarching issue with this virus is that it's a new virus that we haven't had experience with, if you look at its molecular makeup. If you look at the patterns of infection, it is curious, but it's becoming very clear that it has a predilection to infect younger individuals as opposed to older individuals. There are theories about that. The most likely explanation is that older individuals, 55, 60, 65 and older, have had some experience in their past with a virus or a vaccine that is similar, not identical certainly because this is new, to what we're seeing circulating now. So the people who have essentially no immunity are the younger individuals. Among those individuals, obviously, are children, are pregnant women, and people within that category. Pregnancy has always been, not only with this H1N1, but with seasonal flu, pregnancy has always been a risk of complications. So that's not something novel to this new H1N1 of 2009. So it's fundamentally skewed towards younger individuals.
We had a message from Facebook even before the program began from David, who says, why is this issue so big? A flu, it seems, is a flu, is a flu. This one just has a name and has it earlier than usual. Get on board, get vaccinated, and then let's move on to more important subjects for discussion, like heart disease, malaria, AIDS, starvation, and some nasty violence that kills even more people. What would your response be, Dr. Geller?
Well, it's exactly what Dr. Fauci just said. What's different here is the percentage of the population who hasn't had any experience with it. And that's really one of the criteria for a pandemic, is a population that has this vulnerability. So what we've seen, as evidenced by the people who are getting sick, is a sizable portion of the population has not had experience with this. And that's what the concern is here.
Do you expect that more people than those who normally, unfortunately, die from the ordinary flu would die from swine flu?
The answer is that if you get more people infected, if you have what we call a naive population in which there's very little background immunity, and instead of having 5 to 15% of the population getting infected, you have 20 to 35 or 40% of the population get infected. By mere proportion alone, the total numbers of people who get seriously ill are going to be greater. What we don't know, since we don't know what's, we use the terminology, Diane, denominated. We don't know the total number of people that have been exposed. We get attention to the people who get seriously ill and go to hospitals and go to ICUs. What we don't know precisely now is whether there is a bit more of a predilection to give serious disease to younger individuals, or if this just more younger individuals are infected, and that's why you're seeing more serious disease.
Dr. Geller, does the virus at this point seem stable, or is it mutating?
That's really one of the key questions that we keep looking at. As Dr. Schuchat mentioned, there is a surveillance system in place around the world to look for these viruses, and what we've seen so far is the viruses are stable.
That has really important implications, Diane, for what we're doing with vaccine development, because as Dr. Gellin said, that if you look at what we saw early in April, compare that to what's going on in Argentina or Australia now, it's molecularly virtually identical. So the vaccine that we and others throughout the world are making are the vaccine that was circulating then, which is hopefully what we'll see if we see it in the fall.
Dr. Anthony Fauci of NIH, Dr. Bruce Gellin, he's at the Department of Health and Human Services. Do join us, your questions and comments. Going to open the phones in just a few moments after I converse a little further with Dr. Anthony Fauci of NIH and Dr. Bruce Gellin of the Department of Health and Human Services. Is a vaccine available now? Dr. Fauci.
Not available for distribution to the public, but a vaccine is being manufactured. We and the companies are going to be doing clinical trials. We being NIH, our clinical trials will start literally next week, Diane, and to ask some fundamental questions that will help in the decision-making of what is the right dose, how many doses, what about short-term immediate safety. Those questions are going to be asked in a variety of populations. We fully expect that in the fall, likely somewhere in early to mid-October, that there will be vaccine available if the decision will be made by the secretary whether or not to implement the vaccine program, and if so, in what groups. Those are in active discussion right now.
Dr. Gellin.
This is largely about time. As Dr. Schuchat mentioned, this H1N1 virus emerged in the spring. As soon as it was detected, it was taken by the laboratories to transform it in a way that could then begin to make a vaccine. The manufacturers who make the seasonal influenza vaccines are the ones who are working on this, the vaccine.
And what companies are those, may I ask?
Well, there are many around the world. For the United States, we have contracts with the five manufacturers who supply vaccines for our seasonal use. The Sanofi Pasteur, MedImmune, GlaxoSmithKline, Novartis, and CSL, Commonwealth Serum Laboratory in Australia.
Now, how will those companies coordinate or compete for a vaccine?
We and the Department of Health and Human Services, in part of a broader pandemic influenza preparation plan, as well as our plans for seasonal flu, have long-term relationships, contractual relationships with these companies to supply not only the seasonal flu, but in the event of a pandemic, which we're facing right now, doses of the pandemic influenza vaccine. So we have purchase orders, we have relationships with them of varying amounts of doses coming from each of the companies in a way that will be coming in different shifts. For example, we expect the first to come in the where we can administer it in October. I think that's a reasonable assumption that we'll have it in October. You never know with vaccines because production issues may come up. And then after that, there'll be more doses coming in throughout the fall and the winter. That's already prearranged with the companies about which company's going to give this amount and which company's going to give that amount.
How are we going to know which of these companies really puts its finger on exactly the right formulation for swine flu? Yeah,
that's a great question. And as Dr. Gellin said, when the CDC first isolated this early on in the spring in April, they made what's called a seed virus. They got it to grow under conditions where they could distribute it to the different companies and say, get it in your system to start to rev up so that you can produce it. So we're really starting off with the same reference strain. So even though one company is a bit different than the other, they're starting off with the same reference strains.
Go ahead, Dr. Gellin.
And let me add to that, that these are the companies that, as I mentioned before, make seasonal flu vaccine every year.
But as you and I well know, how often has that vaccine been the wrong strain for that current virus?
Well, that is a huge issue, and again, it's one that we wrestle with all the time in trying to improve the match between the viruses that are circulating and the vaccine.
That's why I asked you if it was changing.
As Dr. Fauci said, the virus, as we've looked at it, and places around the world are looking at this every day, right, the virus is stable. So that tells us that at this point, the vaccine that we're making that was derived from the same virus is on target.
Right now, it's a perfect match. What the CDC does, they have surveillance capabilities in the Southern Hemisphere, here in the United States, in Europe, carefully watching what evolution, if any, that virus is undergoing so that they'll know, is it changing molecularly? And right now, the reports as of yesterday are that it's the same virus as it was in April. So that's encouraging news that the vaccine that's being revved up now and produced is matching quite well that virus that's circulating in the United States and now in the Southern Hemisphere.
Okay, and you both promised to come back in October.
Right.
So we can talk then?
Sure. No, absolutely. We do that. But the caveat on all of this is that these viruses are unpredictable, which is the reason why the CDC is following it so carefully. There's no guarantee it's not going to change. The comforting news
right
for us is that thus far it has not.
Okay. What about the concerns of a double barrel flu season? Major ordinary flu, major swine flu. How do you deal with that?
There's no question that this is going to be a complex fall. As Dr. Schuchat and Dr. Fauci mentioned, we have seasonal flu vaccine programs every year, and that is unchanged. The seasonal vaccine is going to be available very soon, and as soon as available, when people should start to take it. Clearly, keeping these separate in the minds of the people who have to understand which vaccines they've received is going to be critically important, because there is some overlap between the groups. To a large part, the way that this the H1N1 epidemic is playing out, as we've mentioned before, is shifted to the younger population who traditionally have not lined up for seasonal vaccine. Right. Some have and some haven't. So in some ways, that makes this a little bit simpler, but there's no question that this is going to be a complex fall.
Yeah, a very important point, and this is going to require good communication, which the department is prepared for, is that with seasonal flu, you want to make sure that the ones that are at highest risk, who are the elderly individuals, the 65 years of age and older, because in the seasonal flu, forgetting about pandemic flu, there are 36,000 deaths due to the flu each year with seasonal flu, more than 90 to 92% of which are among people 65 years of age or older. So even though we're concentrating on pandemic flu, we want to make sure that the people who need the seasonal flu vaccine get the seasonal flu vaccine also.
Is there going to be enough of both vaccines for everybody?
With seasonal vaccine...
It's interesting how I hear silence. It's between you.
No.
You're not sure.
We were trying to figure out who you were calling on.
Okay.
With seasonal vaccine, every year we have more vaccine than there is demand for.
Okay.
And it's always a challenge to try to get that supply-demand just right. It's also worth mentioning, as Dr. Schuchat did mention, that with seasonal vaccine, we recommend it for almost two-thirds of the population, yet fewer than half of those get vaccinated every year. So just because there are recommendations for a certain number of people in the population doesn't mean they all get it.
Do you think that this year could be different because they're hearing so much about swine flu and more about the ordinary seasonal flu that you're going to have a greater demand for both vaccines?
I think it's going to depend. The answer to that is generally yes, Diane. But what I think is going to happen, it's going to depend on what happens in the early fall.
Okay.
Because we are prepared for the worst case scenario. We're preparing for that. But if the fall comes and there aren't really a lot of infections or it's perceived as not being that serious, people psychologically may feel they don't need the vaccine. So there are two possible scenarios that we're getting all this vaccine ready, and there's not going to be a lot of uptake of it. I would rather be in a situation of having the vaccine ready to go and people not taking it, even though I would hope that they would, than not having enough. So we're preparing for the worst case scenario that it's going to be serious and that we're going to be giving a lot of vaccine.
Now, Dr. Gellin, what should people do before they can get the vaccine?
Well, I think that's really the key question. And I think the message is the same as it is for all influenza and all respiratory diseases. Most important is if you're sick, you should stay home because your ability to then infect other people. You should contact your healthcare provider to talk with them about whether or not you need to come in and whether or not you might need to be tested or get some of the treatments that Dr. Schuchat mentioned, particularly people who are at risk of complications from influenza.
So if they're already sick, if somebody has a really bad flu and swine flu is suspected by that individual, is the vaccine going to do any good at that point?
Well, as Dr. Schuchat mentioned, it's important to make sure what it is that person have. If it's indeed swine flu, they've essentially been immunized by that virus.
Yeah, we want to make sure the listeners don't get confused. If you're sick with the flu, a vaccine is not going to help you. Vaccine
That's
is to prevent the flu. If you're sick with the flu, you can be treated. Now, the issue is you want to make sure that if you have mild symptoms and you're not at a risk person, that we don't start treating everybody and running out of drug. The CDC recommends that if you have serious symptoms, you definitely get treated. If you get symptoms of the flu and you fall into the high-risk category, particularly pregnant women, and that's the thing that we've been emphasizing based on experience. If you have a pregnant woman and you suspect, even if you don't have the test back, that she has a reasonably good chance that she has the flu, she should be treated with anti-flu drugs.
Like?
Tamiflu.
Is that the only
drug out there right now, the H1N1 novel virus is sensitive to the two drugs that are the major ones that we're stockpiling, Tamiflu and Relenza.
And when you say we're stockpiling,
yeah,
is that going to be available for everybody?
Oh, the department has been working on this for some time now. They have amounts that they have kept at the federal level. They've distributed to the states a certain amount, and then they've backfilled the amount that they distributed. So they're very, very, very much in attention to this.
Okay. And let's talk a little about school closings, Dr. Gellin. Has that helped at all to slow the spread of H1N1?
I think that it's still hard to tell. I think that it plays out at the local level, and I think in some communities they feel that it might have helped. In some communities, they're not quite as sure. I think part of that is really going back and looking to see what the experience was at the community level. But I think that the jury's still out.
But does the administration have guidelines for schools, Dr. Fauci?
The federal government has broad, general, overarching guidelines and suggestions, but they underscore very strongly that the decisions about schools are left to the state and local levels because things are different in different locations, different states, different regions. So the final decision is definitely at the local level.
Aren't there a lot of economic costs, however, with closing schools, Dr. Gellin?
Clearly, that's one of the considerations.
Yeah.
Because if the kids stay home, then there are ripple effects throughout the community and throughout the society. I think the other piece about the school closure experience is sometimes the schools were closed in part because there weren't enough people to come. That it wasn't necessarily a decision that we should close the school because we're trying to protect everyone, but there was a sufficient number of people who were sick and the schools closed on that basis.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And joining us now from her office in Birmingham, Alabama, Dr. Elizabeth Turnipseed. She's the medical director for disease control at the Jefferson County Department of Health. Good morning to you, Dr. Turnipseed. Thanks for joining us. I understand some students in your county will head back to school on Friday. Are you preparing for an H1N1 resurgence?
Well, you're absolutely right. Our schools do start earlier than many, and we do have students going back this week. I think it's quite likely, like the other doctors have said, I think it's quite likely that we will see an increase in cases. Just because people are coming into a congregate setting, and that does facilitate influenza transmission. And I think we need to be prepared for that, and we're working with local school boards to try and educate them to be aware that there will be disease transmission, what steps they can do to minimize that, specifically if a child presents to school who has influenza-like illness, what teachers and nurses should do about having that child sent home, and also making plans for absenteeism, both among students and potentially among faculty and staff.
To what extent did any of the schools in Jefferson County close last April because of H1N1?
We were quite fortunate. We actually had no school closures. Now, there were some elsewhere in the state, but in Jefferson County, we didn't have to do that.
Okay. And then for you, the question becomes, if you do have a major outbreak, do you have enough resources to deal with it?
We are fairly well positioned, and I think relative to some other local or county health departments, are probably better positioned. Certainly, capacity is always a concern, but we are well-staffed with nurses as well as physicians. We have good relationships with local providers and a volunteer corps, and so I think in terms of manpower, we're in excellent shape. We'll have resource support from the state in terms of any ancillary supplies that are necessary for vaccination that don't come as part of the federal distribution. So I think we need to be vigilant and we need to be aware of where shortcomings or where pressure might arise, but I think we're about as well positioned as we could be here.
But what will you look for from the federal government if H1N1 comes back?
Well, now, I guess I would say that H1N1 is here, and I think, you know, we are prepared to deal with it as a heavy and prolonged flu season that behaves fairly typically, in terms of individual illness presentation, to seasonal influenza, but potentially infects more people. I think as long as that picture persists, we're quite equipped to deal with it with local resources. If the situation changes dramatically and we see an unexpected mortality rate or morbidity rate, I think we may be in a position for needing more infrastructural support, but that would largely go through the state health department, the Alabama Department of Public Health, would then provide us backup support.
And Dr. Gellin, on that point, if a state finds itself in that kind of position needing additional support, what will the federal government do?
Well, we've already tried to get ahead of that, that there have been grants that have given to states, both for health departments and for hospitals, $350 million together. And there's a lot of planning going on to help the states do what they need to do.
Dr. Bruce Gellin, he's with the Department of Health and Human Services, and Dr. Elizabeth Turnipseed. She joined us from Birmingham, Alabama. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Four-star General Anthony Zinni on challenges facing today's leaders, the former chief of U.S. Central Command, on how lessons from the battlefield can be applied to the boardroom. The Diane Rehm Show, Friday. Welcome back, and it's time to open the phones. Let's go first to Joseph, who's in Webster, New York, as we talk about swine flu and the upcoming season where H1N1 is expected to reappear. Good morning to you, Joseph.
Good morning. My question is for Dr. Fauci, and it's based on the history of past pandemics. What is the likelihood that a second or later wave of this current pandemic will become severe? If it happens, and if sufficient effective vaccine is not available, what kind of social disruptions might result, and what preparation should individuals perhaps take?
Dr. Fauci.
Well, that's a very good question, Joseph. This is something that we certainly have in the very forefront of our mind to prepare for. What you're talking about is if this virus, which is now circulating worldwide, somehow mutates and changes to become more virulent or cause more disease and severe disease and death. That certainly can happen It's possible. It does not look like that's going on right now, since the virus is staying almost identical to what it was several months ago. But given the worst-case scenario that that happens, there are a number of other things. First of all, vaccine could still give you partial protection, even though it isn't a perfect match. There's also the contingency of using, with the vaccine, a substance which we call an adjuvant. And an adjuvant is a substance that, when given with the vaccine, not only gives it a more powerful response, but broadens the breadth of the response of covering viruses that might be a little bit different. The other thing is equally, if not more important, is that there are community mitigation strategies that one can implement in the absence of a perfect fit for the vaccine. That becomes a very, very important part of the implementation of a pandemic plan, which is built into the plan that has been developed over years and beginning to be implemented now over the last several months. So even though we would hope that that wouldn't happen, Joseph, there are contingencies of not having a perfect match if, in fact, the virus becomes more virulent.
All right. And here's an email from Christina. She's in Ann Arbor, Michigan. She says, I really hate to ask this question. In yesterday's New York Times, there was a front page article about how Wyeth Laboratories manufactured the need for its hormone replacement drugs through the placement of positive and fabricated articles in prestigious medical journals. The drugs hurt many women. The 8,400 lawsuits now filed against Wyeth are probably the tip of the iceberg. So, she says, why should I trust what the doctors on your program are saying? How do I know this isn't another big pharma scam? Dr. Gallen.
Well, it's pretty clear from Dr. Schuchat's introduction at the beginning of your show, Diane, that this is a global problem. And I think that there's no doubt that all countries around the world are concerned about this. The World Health Organization is doing all it can to prepare all countries about this. On this side of it, on the vaccine side specifically, we've engaged with a number of manufacturers who we work with every day on these things. And the key here, like it is with everything we do, is the data, and the data that drives the decisions.
But there's also the question of trust.
Yeah.
And trust has been shattered in a number of cases.
Oh, there's no question about that. But first of all, to take the first part of Christina's question, this is not a fabricated pandemic. You just need to go anywhere around the world in the Southern Hemisphere now and go to our schools in the spring, and this is a real thing. This is the real deal. So that's not fabricated. The issue of working with pharmaceutical companies, I think that's one of the reasons why we're comfortable about that, is that we are using products that have been the virus isolated by the CDC, made to grow, give to the companies. The companies are making a vaccine, and we in the federal government are testing that vaccine. So it's being tested by public officials in addition to private corporations and private pharmaceutical companies.
All right. To Clinton, Connecticut. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning, Diane. I always love your program, and I compliment you on it.
Thank you.
I have a question for the panel. I am an organ transplant patient, and I recently was at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital and mentioned the H1N1 vaccine to my physician, my cardiologist up there, and she said that she hadn't heard enough to know whether it was going to be suitable, but they were watching it closely. In other words, concerns about live vaccines, or, you know, would somebody like me, who's on immunosuppressants, be able to take it? I can't take anything that's a live vaccine.
All right, Dr. Fauci.
Well, thank you for bringing up this very important issue. You, as a transplant recipient on immunosuppressants, are in the category of a person who's at higher risk for a complication of the flu. So you should get the vaccine when it's available, and you should get the inactivated vaccine, not the live attenuated
vaccine.
So
there'll be
two separate types. So she should get the inactivated vaccine. In addition, If, in fact, you get symptoms of the flu when there's flu in the community, since you are a person at a higher risk and you, for one reason or other, I hope this isn't the circumstance that you don't get vaccinated or haven't gotten vaccinated yet, you should be treated with anti-flu drugs if you get, in fact, symptoms that suggest the flu. So there are two things that you need to stay heads up for.
I hope that helps, Lauren. Now to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Selena.
Good morning to you, and thank you so much. And I'm so glad for that previous caller because it has sort of made my question sort of morph a little bit. My question to you is I have been diagnosed with COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and also, like the previous caller, myself and many others have been recommended in that group to get the flu vaccine. But we also have frequently been treated with corticosteroids, which also has an immunosuppressant quantity to it, although maybe not as strong as the previous caller. So I don't know for sure if that advice would go for what my question is. One, should we get the flu vaccine? And two, if we're on corticosteroids, should we avoid, make, you know, preemptive type measures to avoid anyone who's has the flu? So that's my question. One,
okay. Should
we get it? And two, what about avoidance of those who are infected?
Sure. Dr. Gallen.
Well, Selena, you actually have provided very good advice for the listeners here because you've highlighted that there are a number of people with underlying diseases who have complications when they're infected with influenza. So I think that what your suggestion of trying to avoid exposure is a great one. And similar to the last caller, because you are at increased risk of complications, get the vaccine, both the seasonal vaccine, as soon as it's available, and make sure that you do the same with the H1N1 vaccine when it's available.
But should she not get the live vaccine since she's on corticosteroids?
Exactly. Yes, an immunosuppressive situation. So she has actually a double barrel reason
right. To
be at risk. She has chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and she's on glucocorticoids. The glucocorticoids would suggest that she get and mandate that she get, if she get it, and I hope
right.
she does, the inactivated vaccine, seasonal and a pandemic flu if it becomes available.
Here's an email from Mary Lou. She's in Cincinnati. How has the new swine flu vaccine been tested? What are the known side effects? Your guests are talking about vulnerable populations receiving the vaccine, but how do we know it will not make them more vulnerable to other problems?
Okay. So an excellent question. The vaccine that we're going to have in our implementation program for the distribution of vaccine is being tested literally next week. We're going to put it into the arms of the first individuals. We're going to ask two questions.
Are they volunteers?
These are volunteers.
Okay.
And I can tell you, Diane, we're having no trouble getting volunteers
really?
Into the program. That's absolutely certain.
And are you looking for them?
Oh, yes. We advertise for them, but they are individuals in the various centers throughout the country that we've been involved with now for a long period
are
of time.
Are they healthy people for the most
they
part?
They are. They're healthy people
okay.
of different age range.
Okay.
And the question that the caller asked is that the two fundamental questions that we ask, among others, is that is it safe in the short term, because safety that is measured over years or a very, very, very rare side effect, you literally have to vaccinate millions of people before you know that. But to look at the immediate obvious side effects in the safety issue, and the other is, what is the right dose? How many doses should you give? How should you give them? Those are the questions that we're asking the clinical trials that will literally start next week.
Because she is recalling, I'm sure, the resulting Guillain-Barré from
right.
polio vaccine.
All right. That was a very rare effect. But the interesting thing that we need to point out about that is that that was a situation where the vaccine was distributed, was made and then distributed with the same decision. They were anticipating a pandemic, and there were a few hundred soldiers, recruits in Fort Dix, New Jersey, one of whom died, but there never was a pandemic. So what the public was left with was the risk of a vaccine with essentially no risk of a pandemic because the pandemic wasn't there. We are in the middle of a pandemic, so the risk of a pandemic is right here.
Dr. Gallant, I'm taking 135 NPR listeners on a trip on the Nile this fall. Now, I presume your recommendation to each and every one of those people, since they'll be traveling in other parts of the world, would be to get both vaccines.
As soon as they're able, they should. The other thing that's going to be important is as they approach that ship, if they're sick, they shouldn't board.
Got to make sure of that. Really hard. Really hard. All right. And joining us now from her office in Oakland, California, is Grace Crickett. She's the Chief Risk Officer for the University of California. Grace Crickett, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Diane.
Talk about what the University of California is doing to prepare for possible H1N1 resurgence.
Well, we are doing a lot of things, and we have been very busy actually since April. And since you just mentioned about travel, that's really where we have to start addressing and dealing with the influenza outbreak. So in April, we were paying attention to Mexico, and luckily we have a very sophisticated travel tracking system that allows us to see where the UC family is all over the world, and we do travel a lot. We have 220,000 students. We have about 170,000 faculty and staff. We had implemented a program, not in response to pandemic, but just because we wanted to be able to assist our travelers across the world. So we found out that we had a group of students in Mexico. We were able to pinpoint where they were. We made a decision, actually, to bring them out of Mexico. And because of the system, we were able to coordinate with health providers to have them screened. Since that time, we've had students who have been quarantined in the UK and Japan. Luckily, none of them actually had or were diagnosed with H1N1 or became sick with influenza. But we have had to deal with on-the-ground situations already because of the influenza outbreak.
And let me just pause to remind our listeners, at 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Grace Crickett, what about California's budget crisis? How has that affected how you will approach the H1N1 if there is a resurgence?
The budget crisis is definitely a challenge for the university, but is not changing what we do in regards to dealing with this. Safety issues, health issues are a priority for the university. We have a pandemic advisory group that has been formed, made up of infectious disease specialists and emergency managers within UC that are helping to give us direction. We're monitoring every week what's happening in the campuses and what their resource needs are. And we have special funds that are set aside for situations like this.
Grace Crickett, she is the Chief Risk Officer for the University of California. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Diane.
And finally, to both of you, Dr. Fauci, how different will the vaccine for H1N1 be from the ordinary flu vaccine?
That's a great question, Diane. In so many respects, it's strikingly similar, if not identical, in the way it's made, the companies that make it, the way it's processed. The only difference is that the H1N1, which is the pandemic 2009 that we're talking about, is a virus that, although we have an H1N1 seasonal virus in the vaccine that we do seasonally, they're different molecularly in their molecular makeup, that the one that's we calling the pandemic H1N1 is a new virus in the sense it hasn't been seen before.
Ever.
To our knowledge. There have certainly been viruses that have been similar to it. So it's different enough that you need a separate vaccine for it. But the way you make it and the way the vaccine is done is essentially identical.
How much is it going to cost?
Well, the federal government has orders in for the vaccine that we've already purchased, and we've spent almost $2 billion on the products that are on these vaccine products. So that's the vaccine part of it. Clearly, in addition to that, there are costs of having an immunization program. Part of that, as I mentioned, have been federal support to the states so they can begin to implement this program, but recognizing that a vaccine is just one part of the overall cost of an immunization program.
And, you know, in the past, these ordinary flu shots have been available at drugstores, right, at malls. Are you recommending that people see their doctors?
The state health departments are in the process now of refining their plans of how they're going to run these programs.
I see.
And they know their localities, and they're looking at the combination of ways to mount an immunization program like this.
One quick thing with regard to when you said it is how much is it going to cost is that the federal government doesn't really purchase the seasonal flu except for a small amount in reserve. The federal government is purchasing the pandemic flu.
Dr. Anthony Fauci of NIH, Dr. Bruce Gellin of the Department of Health and Human Services. They both promised to come back in October. Thank you both.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you very much, Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.